It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The weather has warmed up, and for a lot of us, it's time to start focusing on outdoor projects. Maybe this spring, you're thinking big and getting ready to build a garage or a shed. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here to help. Just with advice, he's not actually going to go help you. But
No, I'm not, because it's getting close to Mother's Day, so I got to concentrate my own mom.
All right. But if you have questions this hour, you are welcome to join the conversation. You can send your questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. And Bill, I want to ask a big question first. A garage, you know, a lot of people would think about taking on a garage project themselves who maybe wouldn't think about taking on a home addition themselves. Is a garage as complicated as a home addition?
No. Usually they're pretty easy. That's where you get a few friends together on a Saturday and Sunday. You know, usually if you're just going to do a standard like single, which are kind of rare anymore, to double car garage, you know, you can get it framed up, you know, in a weekend and maybe even get the shingles on if you have some friends that are, you know, familiar with framing, because, you know, usually they're pretty simple. If you buy a package, you know, that's already pre-cut, pre-labeled, things like that, it even goes any faster. But those are, you know, when you look at packages, that's kind of your starting point, you know, because you may want to add different windows and, you know, there might be a lot of regulations that you have to follow, that the package may have to be changed, things like that.
So with a garage, I mean, obviously you have to start at the bottom with the foundation. What do you need to do to get ready?
Well, first of all, you know, you're going to have to find where your property lines are. I have a friend right now.
Don't build your garage on your neighbor's lawn.
You know, and I'm glad you brought that up. I was thinking about that after we talked the other day. I had a friend that owned some property. And a guy built a garage, and it ended up being 2 feet onto the property, of his property. He knew all well what was going on, but he just sat there, you know, this is a good investment on my part. So when the guy got all done, he went over and he said, hey, do you know that your garage is on my property? And he goes, no. And he goes, what am I supposed to do now? He says, well, either move your garage 2 feet or buy that 2 feet of property that you're on. So he got a pretty good price. It was a good investment. And, you know, he didn't gouge him or anything because he knew him. He thought it was kind of funny, but it wasn't, you know, wasn't like a city lot or anything. They were just having a lot of fun.
Know your property
line.
Yes,
but that can be really bad if you don't know where your property line. And don't go by if you're going to invest, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 in a garage, don't just go out there and look for a piece of re-rod or a piece of metal sticking up out by your sidewalk, because 50 years ago, I was with a realtor that he would just kind of eyeball and he'd drive these pins in for property lines. So you may, you know, go down to the city hall or your inspector or, you know, planning and zoning for the county. If you're, especially if you're in town, you want to know where it's actually at. And you may want to, you know, especially if your neighbors aren't, you know, it's maybe a little sketchy as far as how you get along with each other. Maybe get that surveyed beforehand.
Right.
You need to know where easements are at, you know, things like that before you go. But, you know, you have to decide, what am I going to use this garage for? Because if you're going to heat and cool it, and if you put plumbing into it, well, then you're looking at, you know, footings. And if it's attached, if you want it attached to the house, you have to go with footings, you know, that go down like 4 feet or so. There's different ways to do that. And your city or county may have specific requirements on the footings and how that slab, how thick it's supposed to be. Maybe they want you to have it a 6-inch slab. If you're in a little subdivision outside of town, they have covenants, and all of a sudden now they're saying, okay, the garage can only be a certain size, the siding has to match this, the footings, you know, the color of the shingles.
So do all your homework
first. There's so much homework, even for a little stinking shed, you know. I mean, even if you go, you think, well, I'm going to go out and buy one of these little 6-foot by 6-foot sheds, and, you know, just because I don't need a full-size garage. It all of a sudden you pour a slab and you put it on top of it, now you're going to get taxed for it. But if you put it on some skids, you won't. But in Minnesota, you get taxed no matter what. But, yeah, you know, there's you've got a lot of homework to do, and you're really going to have to decide, okay, if I'm going to invest this much money, what am I going to really use it for? If it's just for storage of totes and seasonal, you could call it a garage, but say a small single size garage, maybe 12 by 16 foot that you can get, you know, your lot, like riding lawnmower in or something like that. You know, in that in that vein, you also want to think, well, I'd rather just build it once than build it too small. So a lot of times, let's just go ahead and build a double car garage because everybody's already there. And
you're certainly going to fill it up because everyone can fill a double car garage, whether they think they can or not.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I have so much junk in my barn, I can hardly get my four-wheeler down through the center. Of course, if I organized it, it'd be different. But if you have the space, you tend to fill it up.
Now, you talked about when you attach a garage to the house, which, I mean, a lot of people obviously want their mm-hmm. garage attached to the house. If you want a garage that you can actually drive into, then you'd also like to have it attached to the house.
Yeah.
You don't have to go outside. But that is a lot more complicated than
a
detached garage.
It is. It's a lot more complicated because there's, when you're building a garage, a lot of times there may be some heavy equipment. And if you're working around your existing foundation to attach a garage, your foundation may be not be able to handle the weight of the equipment and who's operating it, how are they close to they getting to your house. If it's a do-it-yourself project, here in Iowa we have quite a few or a high percentage of basements and foundations that are concrete block. Concrete block are very weak when it comes to lateral motion, which would mean the soil pushing against it, so they can fall in or be pushed, curved in. So you have to have somebody, especially in that foundation stage, that understands that they don't want to create any damage, and you have to, have to get all these locations done, and especially. Not so much even what maybe the city has done, but maybe a previous owner, they've got maybe a gas line going out to an old grill and they capped it out in the yard, but then all of a sudden you dig and now there's, you've got a flame in your backyard, an eternal flame going on. And you're looking at electrical, you're looking at heating, you're looking at framing. When you tie a garage into an older structure, if it's not done correctly, the new one may settle, and then you're looking at leaks, you're looking at structural issues. There's a lot more to it, and that's why, especially if you're in town, as soon as you do something like that, that's where an inspector really comes into play, and it may get out of the realm of a do-it-yourselfer. A simple detached garage sitting out in the backyard way back, clear in the back corner of the lot or something, that's one thing. But when you're getting in some bigger issues when you attach it.
All right. So you mentioned kits.
Right.
Do you think that's a good way to go? Do you like these sort of, they're not prefabricated, but they're put together for easy assembly.
Some are okay. They're not, we don't see as many of them around here in Iowa because we tend to, have all these different sizes of garages. But you go to larger cities, Des Moines has some areas where they'll just bring in a package like a prefab home and they set the walls up, put the roof on, they're gone that day. But when you buy just the materials package, in many times if you buy it, from a good lumber yard, it seems like the materials are maybe a step above what you would get if you just went out and went piecemeal. So because they don't want any callbacks on a kit. So I found that a lot of times the materials are maybe a little bit better, especially in the framing lumber, and if they have a really good set of directions. And the nice thing about buying it from, say, a lumber yard is there's somebody there that if you get a question, you can call and you can ask them. And, they think, well, I might be able to sell them something else down the line. So they'll come by and maybe help you out a little bit or suggest someone that can help you because there's some, there's a lot of contractors that are only, one or two person, and they have no problem with going out and laying everything out and helping you do certain things, but yet you do the majority of it. They may frame it up and say, okay, now you can take it from here, so that may save you some too. Now the small kits, like for sheds, a friend of mine, I just talked with him the other day, and I wish I would have been there because he gets up early. He started at 4:30 in the morning, and he finished, I think it was 8:30 that night. Okay, this was one of those little sheds you buy at a big box store, and he was trying to do it himself, okay, and it was windy. So here he's trying to put nuts and bolts in, and that's why I wanted to be there, because I wanted to see things just flying around the yard as he's screaming and hollering and swearing. But, you always need to have somebody else there to help you hold things. So some of those can go up very well. You do have to remember, though, the lighter the structure is, the more susceptible it is usually to wind. And, we have a lot of wind. So in most cases, you know, I'd recommend you put a substantial, like a wooden structure, and put some good money into it, because that's a good value. You know, that adds to the property, especially if you do some nice landscaping and maybe have, you know, like say an overhanging roof where you can, maybe some people are doing, you know, even these outside kitchens they're putting out on these small buildings instead of having them close to the house because it helps on their insurance rates. So they put them out there and have a small patio area. I mean, you can incorporate it into a, you know, a garden shed, just call it that. So.
You're full of wisdom to get around.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But lay this out a little bit more for me. I mean, a lot of these kits can go together quite well, but you're saying just make sure that you're paying for something that is heavy enough, substantial enough, that it's going to withstand the weather.
Yeah, you know, most of the time when it's going to be like a wood structure, we're going to be in pretty good shape. But still, if you build a small, like a 6 foot by 6 foot, which to me, I don't know why you'd even bother building something that small, you know. But if you built something that small, and you build it 8 feet, 10 feet in the air, you know, if you don't anchor it down, that's the bad thing sometimes about putting these smaller sheds just on concrete block. You'd want to put a substantial treated wood floor underneath it with treated wood, you know, 3/4 inch plywood, so you can, you know, put a mower in there. The nice thing about
something seems too inexpensive to be true.
Yes,
it is.
It's like anything else. It is. You get what you pay for. Because I was looking at last night. I was looking at different, you know, companies that have garage kits, and I was really surprised to see a double car garage. It was $42,000. Well, when I started looking what was in it, and the, you know, and the siding that was on it, and the windows on it, and the electrical, and then you have it had a beautiful concrete slab underneath it with an approach. You know, it's like anything else. You start adding these little steps to it, the price dramatically goes up.
So don't spend too little, don't spend too much. Words to live by from Bill McAnally.
Oh, boy.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. He is here to answer your questions about the projects in your life. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here. He has been talking with us about taking on the project of building a shed or a garage, but he's also here to answer your questions about any of the projects on your to-do list. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have this tweet from Garen. Bill, he said, is building on skids really a way not to get taxed? By the way, what is a skid?
Well, skids are when you put the small shed on top of like 6x6s or 4x4s so that you can drag the shed to a different location at any time. So it's considered a portable building. Now, I could be wrong if they've changed. You know, your county may be different, but I can remember when we were doing those, you know, years ago, that they said that wasn't taxed because it's a portable building. But like I said, in Minnesota, now I found that out the hard way, that no, they still tax you on that no matter where you move it. But
all right. but also you were just saying that you probably don't want to build a shed on a skid because it could get damaged if there's high wind or something like that.
And usually what's the odds that you're going to move it anyway? And concrete floors are really neat. But I would say, though, if you're going to put a concrete floor underneath, even a little shed, especially on a garage, though, even on a little shed, I still would put at least one inch of foam underneath it. I mean, extruded foam, which is the blue or green or pink high-density foam.
For insulation?
Well, only because what it'll do is it'll keep the slab from having that condensation on it in the spring. So, like, it keeps it when it starts to warm up, that the ground is still cold, that you'd get condensation on top of that concrete. So let's just say you leave a pipe wrench or something on the floor, and then you go in there in the spring, and now it's all covered with rust because the whole slab is wet. Well, it'll be dry if you put foam underneath. And that's pretty much every new home now is putting foam underneath the slab so that it helps on the condensation. And it does help insulate, but especially on a garage, you never know if you're going to heat it later. And you might as well put foam underneath it now. And I know some people, it's not affordable. Well, you know, maybe not right now, but down the road, it's going to be affordable because you decide to heat it, and it's kind of tough to heat that cold slab.
All right, so invest a little bit more
right,
up front.
Right, but yeah, skids are just something so you make it portable.
All right, Terry is on the line in Ankeny with a garage question for us. Hi, Terry.
Yes, hello, good morning.
Morning.
My question was, what are the thoughts of a garage bump out?
Instead of
a whole new garage or a third stall, just a little bump out.
Oh, yeah, that's great because you drive around, especially the newer homes, it seems like about at least half of them have three-stall garages. So, yeah, putting a bump out is usually, you know, it's very easy to do. Just match the foundation that the original garage has. But the hard part comes in a lot of times with tying in the roof. You know, if you do a bump out, let's say you have a gable, which is just, you know, two shed roofs that meet at the top, just a simple peaked roof. If you put a bump out on the side, you know, now you're going to have to maybe put a gable roof that faces the other direction, and then you have two valleys, and you may have to get somebody that, you know, is familiar with, you know, cutting rafters to meet the angles, or you can buy a truss kit from the lumber yard, you know, manufacture the small trusses. But just doing the bump out, that's a really good way to get, you know, some quick extra footage. And what I, you know, you start to see what they put in. More people have four-wheelers. More people put a bump out, like what he's talking about there, for their boat, because otherwise that chews up half of your garage.
Right.
So they'll put that bump out on. That's a really good thing to do if you have the space. You know, and like I say, you just want to be sure and match the style of footing that the original garage has.
All right, here's an email question from Mike in Windsor Heights. I need to replace my 27 Pella roll screen windows on my 60-year-old brick house. How can I review the various replacement windows on the market to be sure I'm getting one of the best? I'm leaning toward all vinyl windows. What do you think about that?
Well, you can look at all vinyl or look at a fiberglass. There are several companies that will make replacement windows and basically historic replacement windows to fit exactly the opening that you have and for your application. You know, there's a lot of different companies that do it. I think Pella still does it, but like Caradco, you know, Marvin, these different companies. But there's some newer ones that are with fiberglass. And the reason with fiberglass is fiberglass doesn't expand and contract as much as vinyl. The other reason you may want to go with either, you know, 100% vinyl or fiberglass other than wood, in many cases, especially with older homes, is they don't have the ability to keep the moisture off of the windows because they tend to, their heating and cooling system doesn't move enough air to kind of wind wash the glass so that, you know, warm air in the winter will keep the moisture from condensing, or the air from condensing on the vapor condensing on the glass. And people have more of a tendency now for privacy to have full coverage drapes, or, you know, those blackout drapes for sleeping. You want to have the room completely black. Well, when you do that, there's no air to get to the glass. And so there may be moisture on those windows every morning. And you have to understand that that's just the way it is. If you can't get air there to keep that glass warm enough so there's no condensation, you're going to have it. So that when you raise the blinds in the morning, there's going to be moisture. So that at least you can wipe, you know, and clean, keep the fiberglass or vinyl, keep it clean so you don't have mildew going there. But if you have wood over a period of time, it's going to ruin that, you know, that window sash. So that's another thing to think about. The window, you know, can only do so much so that there's no condensation, and you're in control of that. It's not the window. Everybody thinks, oh, the window's failing. No, it's you that are failing. You know, you don't understand, you know, building science and physics. So, you know, you have to maybe raise that blind up a little bit, or you may have to have some more air movement. You know, there's a lot of things to go in when you do replacement windows. But, you know, the newer vinyl ones are very good. But, I kind of look toward maybe some of the fiberglass ones, too, especially if you're replacing the end of brick.
All right. Here's a question from Roger in Cedar Rapids. I have a carpeted stairway from the main floor of my home to the lower walkout level. I want to replace the carpet with wood or cork tiling. Is that wise and feasible?
The wood, you know, it depends on what the structure is. On the stringers. Now, the stringers usually there's three of them that, you know, kind of look like that, the back of a shark or a saw blade. You know, they go down to hold your risers and treads. So it depends on how that is built. You may have to pull all of that off and replace it with solid oak risers and stringers. That's very, you know, it's a very nice method. I would rather, in most cases, you know, go with the wood than the cork, because the cork can get torn. Maybe if you do the tip of the tread. On each tread, do that in oak, and then have where most of your foot lands on the tread, have that in cork. You can do a combination. Or what a lot of people do, we'll do a wooden oak stairs, and then they'll run a carpet, you know, runner down the center, and have these really cool brass highlight rods and everything on it. Cork is really durable, but stairs are really, they get a lot more impact, I would say, because you have more weight coming down in a certain spot, because, you know, you're going from step to step.
You step in the same place every single time.
Yes,
almost, yeah.
You are almost exactly in the same place. And especially if it's the same people, you know, you have a certain style and a gait, and you're exactly right. And then you're going to be using it for moving things up and down. So you're talking, you know, maybe furniture dollies. You're talking, you know, knuckleheads dragging something down the stairs. So but a nice set of oak, you know, wooden stairs would really be nice to go with.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. John is on the line in Adel. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We bought a retirement home in Clive, and it doesn't have a third-car garage, and we're looking to build a workshop. And I'm wondering if the best solution is the workshop in the backyard in a shed, or to build on a third-car garage on the side of the house?
You know, I would do the detached, and mostly because of insurance. If you're going to have a workshop, you know, they when you look at insurance, you can only have so many gallons of flammables, let's say, you know, in a garage attached to the house, and it may be even for a detached. But when you have certain flammables, keep them away from the house. That really helps. It's a lot safer for you. You can keep that in a different, especially for a workshop, you can keep it at a different humidity. You can keep it at a different temperature than what the house is. A lot easier. You're not worried about dusts and fumes transferring back and forth. Now, one thing you may want to get with the city right away, or planning and zoning, or checking that particular area where your rental is, because I was just dealing with this up in Cedar Falls that we were talking about putting a small shop in the, they've got a huge backyard. It's like a 3/4 acre lot. So there's this huge backyard. I'm thinking, well, let's just put, like you're just thinking, let's put a workshop back there. And all of a sudden we're finding out, okay, it can only be 100 square feet and the siding has to exactly match the house. Well, okay, how am I going to match, you know, aluminum siding from 1978?
Right.
And, you know, why build that little of a shop? You can't now to have a workshop, because the neighbor was going to build something similar to what you were going to do, and they couldn't. They found out from the city they couldn't do it. So I would check with them first, and they may be able to go through, you know, through the variance system of, you know, the neighbors saying, okay, it's all right. But I'd check that first. But I would rather, especially if it's a shop or working on, I'd rather, you know, me personally, I'd rather see it kept separate. It's that way you can keep your electrical separate if you want to. You can submeter it. But especially for the environment side of it, especially in a shop, is controlling the dust or fumes, whatever kind of you're going to use it for. It's a little safer that way.
What's the benefit to keeping your electric separate?
Well, then, you know, it depends. If you want to have that submetered, then you can, if it's a shop for work,
okay,
then it's a lot easier to take it off on taxes. All That's right. one thing. And then,
Just
but
to
you
monitor
can control
it.
You can monitor it, yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, John, thanks a lot for your call.
Question.
We have a tweet asking if you have any thoughts on shipping containers converted to storage or living spaces. This person thinks it would be a nice extra space.
Yeah, I have quite a few friends that have bought those. You know, you can get those for like $2,500. The hard part's, you know, shipping them, because they're doggone heavy, and putting them where you're going to put them.
Right.
We've looked at them because you see on TV where they use them for living, and a friend was going to do
tiny
that.
Tiny houses, yep.
Tiny house. The scary part is, and the, that the only concern to me was, okay, what did they haul in that? And what kind of chemicals are in that floor? Because almost all of them have a wooden floor in them, and I don't know what's in that. So I want to make sure to encapsulate that somehow so that I can make sure that whatever they haul in there isn't getting into my environment. If you're going to insulate it, you may want to think about, am I insulated on the inside? They're already little. Okay, now to bring it to insulate, like, say, 6 inches or even 3 inches on each side, you're knocking a half a foot off the inside. The height, you know, you probably want to put a roof over it and insulate on the top side of that. They're really good for storage. They're excellent for storage. Making a tiny house on me personally, I'm always nervous about that environmental side of it. And a friend of mine told me, you know, if you even in a tiny house, which was really cool, is, you know, you start off in the nighttime and it's 30% humidity, one person is sleeping in this little tiny house, and if you don't have ventilation, bring a fresh air, take a stale out, you wake up in the morning, it's 80% humidity just from one person breathing in there. So you put two people in, you know, so you've got to look at the mechanical side. You know, they're hard to put windows in.
Almost like sleeping in a car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Except you can't, you know, crank that radio up in the dash. But it is about like a car. There's some really good sides to them, and I don't know if this is a phase. They're great for storage. I mean, they really are great for storage. As a tiny home, for fast, okay, but, you know, you got to remember, I would rather you insulate them to the inside to encapsulate and keep the chemicals that's in the actual shell of that.
So would you
material.
Rather build in a grain bin?
You know, the grain bin thing, I have a friend that was involved with them. I think it was in Haiti. They went down.
Yeah.
And they're the only ones that held up to the hurricane, you know, for temporary storage or, you know, or for a small, you know, home.
Living, right.
It's a good idea. Would me personally, no. No, I'd have a hard time. You know,
but you might be less concerned about chemicals in the environment.
Yes, yes. I would, because I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I'm always nervous about what they hauled in there and what they spilled on that wood. And, you know, okay, they're hauling them all over the world. They don't have any concern a lot of times on chemicals. What if they hauled, you know, cyanide? I don't know, something in that. I have no idea. It just makes me a little nervous on that as an environment. That's just me, though.
If you have questions for Bill McAnally, email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Dominique. She says, what is the best way to heat and cool a freestanding structure that's not attached to the house?
A mini split heat pump. They're an air source heat pump. If you talk to a heating and cooling person, it just goes by the term mini splits. And what they usually are is a small wall-mounted unit that's maybe 18 inches by 48 inches. And then it has, that's the basically the fan and the controls. And then it has a small outside condenser. You see them all over the place if you start looking for them. You know, even in movies, you see a ton of them in walls. That's what I have in my garage up in Minnesota. It was a do-it-yourself one. We bought it online. Some friends from some electrical co-ops kind of told me about these, and we put some in a couple friends, and it took about an hour and a half to put in. It's a low-budget one, and you know, it's not a high-dollar one, but it heats and cools the garage, and it heats it down to, with the outside temperature, when it gets down to about maybe 15 degrees, then you would need some maybe baseboard electric heat. But for cooling, it's fantastic. But that was the old generation, because now the new generation ones are good down to the outside temperature of about 25 below. They'll still produce heat, be able to heat, you know, the garage. The nice thing is it's electric, so you don't have an open flame. And so you just size it for the square footage. But there again, it depends on how well you insulate it, how well you air seal it. And you have to have some ventilation. And usually, you know, especially on a garage, the big problem is the garage door. So you have to have a good insulated and weather-stripped, you know, garage door. But to me, that's ideal, because it's just a small remote control, and I like the idea of it being electric. Otherwise, I know if you can do a lot of mechanical work, a lot of people go with the in-floor heat. But still, you have to have air conditioning, and a mini split's very high efficiency on cooling.
Well, and it seems appealing, too, for the long term, because it sounds like it's easy to replace down the line.
It is. You know, and you know, I did the do-it-yourself. Most people people, you have a heating and cooling person in, and they'll size it correctly, and the nice they like them too, because they're easy to put in, they're very low maintenance. The technology's been around forever. It's just that's kind of what now we're starting to see, actually a lot more apartment buildings going to this as well. But that would be the choice to me. I'd really stay away from like a wood burner or something, because you never know when you're going to have some open gas, that you're working in there, and any flammables. And I know a lot of insurance companies won't cover it that well. But, yeah, look at a mini split
for
that.
And so that's specifically if it's a garage, if it's a different kind of structure that's not attached to the house, you could have a little more flexibility
there. A little bit, yeah. Yep.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You can join the conversation with your questions. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here with us this hour, here to answer your questions. You can email us your questions at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. You can also give us a call at 866-780-9100. And let's go to the phones. Paul is on the line in Muscatine. Hi, Paul.
Yes. We're in the process of. I'm hearing a little echo here.
Oh, okay.
Just to push on through if you can, Paul. What's the question?
Okay, I'll fight through it. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. Yeah.
Oh dear.
All right. Well, I'll. I guess that's not working right now. Sorry about that, Paul. Let's get back to an email question, and this one is from Emery. She says, I wonder, is there something I can use other than regular filters to decrease the amount of dust in my house?
Well, yeah, a lot of it is maybe the type of vacuum that you have. If you go with a central vacuum or some of the newer canisters.
I bet she's trying to avoid having dust come into her house.
You think so?
I do.
Oh, okay. Well, I got slapped on that one. Let's see.
She probably wants to vacuum less.
Oh, well, that's not supposed to be that way. Yeah. Well, if you tighten your house up, that's one way. You may want to see where the air is coming in to the house, down around your furnace and heating and cooling. If you have an older home, you may want to go down there and see if someone hooked up a maybe 4-inch diameter pipe that just goes maybe through one of the, if you have an older home, through maybe one of the window panes in your basement, and it just goes out and it's open to the outside. And for a while, they were using that as a fresh air intake when the newer type furnaces came in, and they may have left that, so there's no filter at all on that. So when the equipment runs, especially like your dryer, when for the dryer, there's air going out the vent. Well, there's got to be air coming in. It can be dragging air from outside. There may be some big air leaks. You may have to check your weather strippings on your doors, check your windows to see if they're leaking in a lot. Because if they're leaking in a lot, you'll see, if there's any little bit of moisture at all, it'll basically almost look like a mud ring around your windows. Look there. But yeah, you can get an upgraded filter that is still thin, because I don't know what kind, she has. But I would be changing my filters more often. And if you're running them more often, maybe set your fan to run more often. And so that way it's going to catch more of the dust. It'll keep the air moving, and it'll pull the dust out. Because if you're not running your fan very often, well, then the dust will just kind of accumulate. But you may want to look in. Sometimes you just have to vacuum more. You may have more, if you have pets, because, they say basically, your human cell, skin cells or the flakes of skin in that is a lot of your dust. But if you have any dogs running in and out and off and you have your doors open, a lot of times it isn't from from the outside so much. It's more buildup from the inside. So, you know, maybe take a look. And you may have to vacuum, but I would look at, Smarty, I would look at, like, maybe, you know, a central air or the newer type canisters, because the type of vacuums that have the bag, it seems, especially if you do it when the sun's coming in and you run that vacuum through the sunlight, you can see all the dust seems like coming out of the bag.
Up,
yeah, just kicked out. So that may be what it is, too. But check for, you know, weather stripping around doors and windows first,
okay,
too.
All right. Here's a question from DeWitt in Cedar Falls. I had a retaining wall fall down, and I'm thinking about using the bricks to make a fire pit. My first question is, could I put that fire pit on top of concrete, or will that wreck the concrete?
Well, it probably will wreck the concrete. The other thing is, some bricks aren't made to be close to a fire. There are some that if they're really an open cell type of brick, there are some that are, that let's say you can get them very wet. They're not a fired brick. So if they take in a lot of moisture when it heats up, then it goes poof, or you know, breaks apart and crumbles. So it depends on what
right,
type
so check
of brick.
Your bricks.
Check the brick. But when you do put it down on top of concrete, you know, it's going to probably ruin that concrete unless you have a good base of maybe some rock underneath it, you know, say 6 inches of rock like limestone that's underneath where your fire is. Because, you know, when we have a fire and then it rains, well, then all of that kind of wet gook sits on top the concrete. And then when it starts to heat up and it gets down into the pores of the concrete and it's wet, you have expansion, contraction, and it can fracture the top. So, you know, I would maybe put it off to the side. Or...
All right. And then he does have a follow-up question.
Okay.
If I moved it out to the grass, what do I do to make sure that's safe?
Yeah, if you're moving it out to the grass, then, you know, I would get one of those metal liners that they sell a lot of times at hardware stores, whatever, maybe a 36-inch metal liner. And then you can put your brick around the outside. Then that brick is not going to, you know, get heated up like it would if it was right in the fire, and then you're probably okay. But make sure that there's rock underneath it, and you know, just make sure that it's quite a ways from anything flammable. And there again, you know, people have to worry about which way those embers go. And if you do get a fire ring, look for the screen that goes over the top, the ember containing screen that goes over. It may kind of goof up your ambiance or whatever, but it's nice to have that, especially if you're, you know, invariably people throw leaves and grass, and then those embers go a long ways. And there's, you know, certain times in the season where we can get in a lot of trouble.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. George is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, George. Hey, George.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Yep.
What's your question?
Okay, great.
Can you hear us, George?
I want to run some electrical wiring underground.
Okay.
Is there a certain type of wire I have to use?
Yeah, it'll be rated for underground. It says right on the wire. And don't use a wire unless it does say underground right on the coating. But me personally, I always run it in conduit. Because even though it's rated underground and you put it, you know, most of the times they'll say, well, 12 inches is good. I know most guys like to go at least 24 inches down. And if you put it in conduit, you can always pull it out and replace it. So I would do that as well. It seems like, I know it's rated for underground, but it's not rated for that shovel. And that may be just overprotective, but I just really like putting it in there. But it says underground right on the Romex covering, on that plastic covering on the wire. And whatever you're hooking it to, it will say what size gauge that you have to have. And this is where you may want to consult an electrician, because it depends on also how far you're going to that garage. Because if you're going a long distance, you know, you're not going to be carrying the same amount of, let's say, juice at the end as if it was, like, say, 20 foot as opposed to 200 feet. So you'll want to either ask an electrician, or in many times wherever you buy the wire, they'll have a book there and it'll say whatever the distance is. And you want to make sure also that it's on, you know, a GFI, ground fault circuit interrupter, or, you know, maybe an arc fault.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, George. Here's a tweet from Tom. What are your thoughts on the resin composite sheds? Okay, or go with wood?
Well, you know, the resin composites are usually very lightweight, no maintenance. So, if you're in a city and it's very well protected, there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. Remember, they're going to fade. They're not going to look near as good in 10 years. This is what they do now. In winter, some of them, the cheaper ones, become very brittle. And so, like, if the wind catches the door when it is really cold, it may fracture. Some of them don't hold up very well in direct sunlight as well. They tend to get brittle and expand and contract, and then they fracture as well from becoming very brittle in the sun. So I would really go back and look at reviews on the particular brand that you have, and try to do a lot of looks at reviews, because I think some of them are a little bit overpriced for what you're getting, and they also tend to sag. So it's there again, you're kind of getting what you pay for. So having a real nice wooden one, I think it really adds also to the house, especially if you have some glass to it and have, you know, a nice pitch to it and have some design to it, so that it, when people look in the backyard, they go, wow, hey, that's pretty cool. Put a little landscaping around it. Because you get one of those Roswells back there, somebody's going to, oh, great, where am I going to haul this thing to? Because after a few years, they kind of tend to look like that.
All right, here's a question from William. I have an old historic home in Davenport with an 80-year-old garage that's leaning off its cracked foundation. I also have an underground tank of some kind buried next to that old foundation. Can I cap the old foundation and build a new garage or straighten the old garage? And what are the restrictions concerning underground tanks?
The underground tanks is really scary because, you know, hopefully all it is an old cistern.
Right, a cistern that would catch rainwater. And there's a lot of those.
There's
next
a lot
to
of those
houses,
around.
Right?
But you just never know. So
how can he know?
He could have that tested. He can get a hold of the DNR and look at and find out what their regimen is for testing tanks, and they can have somebody come around and take a look at it. But as far as straightening it, you know, some contractors straightening up the garage, that may be the best way to go. But you can just get on the internet, do some searches, and look for barn straighteners, because these guys can take these, you know, these huge barns and
that
straighten
are
them up.
Leaning that way, right?
Oh yeah, you I mean, this garage would be nothing for them. So I would do that because you want to keep the historical significance of it. That's the bad thing. You have this old house, 80-year-old house, and then you, no matter how you try to match or mirror the design on that house, it's still going to look like you stuck a new garage there.
Right.
And so it depends on what you want. If you want to keep that weathered kind of look, yeah, look for barn straighteners.
So what does he do about the cracked foundation?
The cracked foundation, they'll handle that as well.
Okay.
Yeah, most of them, they're kind of full service. They're there's a ton of them in Iowa, but there's a lot of them in Iowa, a lot of them in Wisconsin. I know, because they do a lot of it, and most of them do really, really neat work. And it's, you know, it takes somebody's got a lot of critical thinking skills, because, you know, you're pushing here, pulling there, it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
I would get a big kick, you know. I think William hopefully would get a kick. I just watch and see how they do it, because it's pretty neat.
So you're wishing your garage
was
leaning,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Who says it's not?
Here's a question from Amy. She says, about 9 years ago, we replaced our Pella roll screens, original to our 1940s house, with new wood Pella windows. We've been fighting mold and mildew in the windows on the main floor ever since. Many of these windows do not have any coverings. We are also lazy about closing the curtains and blinds at night. Any advice?
Yeah.
So she's not keeping the coverings on too much, like you talked about earlier.
Right. Well, it may come down. It depends also on what type of finish is on those, whether it's an exterior polyurethane, or you may want to get a hold of Pella and find out, you know, maybe there was a series where they had some issues with the sashes. The other thing is with certain polyurethanes, well, any type of covering you put on wood, when the sun comes in, the sun tends to break it down as well. So it's not something you can just do 10 years and let it go. There's a significant amount of upkeep to wood windows, especially if the sun is going down. I would get with a company, and they'll understand. Hopefully they'll understand and be able to help you through this, because there's no reason that you should have any problems with the wood if it's been finished correctly as per the directions. And they'll be able to give you the directions to what they were originally, especially if you bought the house in second hand. But a lot of it comes back to maintenance. But it also comes back as when, especially with the sashes that open, you know, say casements, when they open, many times the part that's always closed is hidden. That was maybe just stained, but it was never finished correctly with, you know, like the water repellent, polyurethanes, things like that. So, you know, there may be some issues. So I would get with the company and take some pictures, you know, grab the phone, take some pictures, send it to them and say, okay, this is what I, you know, this is what I have and I need to find out what's wrong. Because it's their product, they want to stand behind
it. All right, this is from Laura. We purchased a new house and we're learning its intricacies. I have a question about siding. The home is covered with vinyl siding. Underneath is the original wood siding. It's a two-story home. The vinyl siding runs vertically and there's a horizontal lip that runs crosswise along the perimeter of the home. It appears that the upper section of the vinyl siding sits above the horizontal lip and the bottom section of the vinyl siding sits below it. Water appears to collect in this small lip. My question is, how does this water not seep behind the vinyl and soak into the original wood siding? And what would be a good next step to know that this siding is sound?
Well, hopefully that horizontal piece that she's talking about, hopefully it's basically shaped kind of like a Z, so that a sideways Z, so that the part you see is visual. It goes straight back against the wood siding, and then it goes up. Basically what flashings do. So when the water comes down the vinyl siding, the front or the back, when it goes through the vinyl siding, that it hangs onto the vinyl siding, and then it sneaks down on top of this flashing, and then it comes out, and then you'll see it dripping over the one below it. And so if you see water dripping over that, it's probably working right. Now, vinyl siding is usually very easy to pull off and do inspection. They have vinyl siding a tool you can buy those hardware stores. It's basically a little hook that you can unhook the siding and then you can look what's behind there. Now, do that on warm days. Do not do it when it's cool because you don't want to have these things cracking and fracturing.
Right.
And be very careful on how you do it. But you can inspect that. You can get siding people to do that as well for you.
All right. Let's try to slip in one more fast question here from Jeff in Cedar Rapids. I'm redoing a shed that used to be a summer kitchen from the 1930s. We're going to do the floor and heat the shed during the winter. How do we insulate the floor underneath? It's only on a skid.
Oh, okay. Well, if it's only on a skid, now you're going to have to build a floor. So you're going to have to build a wooden floor. You may have to raise the whole building up and maybe put new concrete floor underneath it, which would really be good. And then you would insulate it with 2 inches of extruded foam. So go to a lumberyard and tell them you're doing a slab and I need the concrete that goes underneath it. And then what you want to do, since you are going to do it that way, is look up and just Google frost protected slab foundations or frost-free foundations or frost-free slab foundations. Google that and it will tell you, it will show you all the pictures on how to install the concrete, the rock underneath it, the foam, and the footings all in one.
All right. Well, Bill McAnally, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, he comes by once a month to answer our questions about home improvement projects. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too, at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.